if you ask my wife, or at the end of the day, I'll be like super down. And it's like, yo, is everything okay? Like, yeah, it's just like, it was a hard day, like drawing. And she'll bust my balls too. Like, did the fucking shirt sleeve that you were drawing, like, was it tough? That's an insane thing to have put me in such a bad mood that, like, yeah, I had a tough day drawing.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tradecraft Podcast. I'm Alex. I ran out of train tracks in my outline, so I had to go back into that. You know, just as I'm kind of digging into that, that's when, of course, my client work gets out of hand, and that takes me away from the book for another week. And I just sit there, you know, pining, looking at Scrivener, thinking like, boy, I can't wait to get back to writing. Rather than being completely beset by this lack of productivity, I abandoned listening to a book on tape or a podcast while I was going for walks. I've never been great at writing while I'm walking. It's a real challenge for my brain to hold on to things in a linear fashion when I am exercising. What the hell, I'm just going to try. And I did. And a few things came through. So then I said, all right, well, I'm going to go for my, you know, my 6 mile hike on Sunday, and I won't listen to anything. And that didn't work out nearly as well because it is a brutally steep climb. And I just was focusing on breathing. I got a couple of things. And then today, some more stuff. And I was able to work on the timeline. I recognize that I have other tools at my disposal, which I'm a master at losing these tools. Like I think I should really literally get a toolbox and write on pieces of cardboard all these things I can do, because I do forget them all the time. And one of them being something Hope Larson tipped me off to on her latest book, Be That Way. Her book took place over the course of a year, and she ended up making a calendar for the whole year, and she put all the pieces together so she could visually look at all these entries that made up her book. And it was such an elegant and simple solution that, you know, I had the big duh moment came, you know, hit me. And then I told my friend, and they were like, oh my God, like, that's such a great idea. So my book takes place not over a long period of time. And I'm like, all right, guess what? Tomorrow, I'm just going to make this calendar, and I'm going to just start plunking all the junk in there. This week's guest is Jonathan Marks Baravecchia. Now, he may have the most impressive last name. Jonathan reached out to me. He has a new book coming out, Bear Pirate Viking Queen, yet another great name. And this is from Image. And it was a great talk. I mean, boy, it was just one of these things where he was as willing to kind of like dive into his own self and into myself as we kind of wound through his creative thoughts. And his touchstones are all these, you know, luminaries, and I get it, and I see where it's all coming from and how it's all coming together. And it's just great. So, you know, he's just another example of how fortunate I am to sit here and have these conversations with people whose work and thought process absolutely fires up all my creative receptors. And I feel rejuvenated from these conversations. I hope you enjoyed the talk as much as I did. This is me and Jonathan Marks Baravecchia. Creativity by nature, even though you're like, I mean, it's a selfish act. You know, it's you doing something for you with the veneer of like, no, I mean, I'm doing this to share this with people. You know, like that's the sort of, you know, that may be the game that we play. But, you know, we really in our hearts are really only driven to do it for ourselves. Nobody says, boy, I can't wait to get to those spreadsheets, man. Cause like this is it.
Yeah. This is my voice. It's funny you say that. I was watching a show the other day. There's a show on Netflix or on HBO or something about glass blowing. It's a competition show. And one of the guys was saying, like, he's like, everything I do, you know, here in the glass blowing studio, he's like, everything I do, my kid, this is all for my daughters. This is all for my, this is all for them.
Yeah.
It's like, man, shut the fuck up. Like, no, it's not. I'm sure you love your kids. And I completely agree with you. Like, all the, like, no one is like, you know what would benefit my family if I were a creative,
right.
if I were an artist right. or a glass, like, shut up.
Right, right.
This is for us. Right. This is a selfish act.
Nobody put their arm around you and said, Jonathan.
Yeah.
It's time for you to really, really start painting things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No one ever does that.
Like,
you know, I mean,
no.
we get that in the smallest forms of somebody saying, wow, this is really good when you're like six or eight.
100%.
And you go, oh, I guess I'm good at this. And then like, if you're fortunate enough to have someone who's like, you know, sort of fostering this, you know, burgeoning, and I'm almost loath to use the word talent sometimes, because it's I've always been that mindset of like, I could teach anybody to do anything that I can do in 6 months. 6 months you can do it, no problem. I'm not saying you're going to be great at it, but you can do it. But it requires absolute deliberate focus. There is no unwavering of like, I don't know, I don't 100%. Think I want to do that today, like, well then you'll never get it. But if you say 100%. Every yeah, I don't know. So
I say this to people all the time, like the talent in air quotes of the artist is just that like drive to mm-hmm. do that 100% of the time. You can learn how to draw or paint or sing or dance.
Right.
But like, do you really want to do it 12 hours a day for 40 years, 30 years to become proficient?
Right.
And then make a career out of it. Right. Like,
and the career is a very lightly penciled in word, you know?
Yes.
You know, it's tough. I was talking with a guy I went to college with, and you know, he's, well, I guess so, he's probably 54 now. I'm going to guess he's 54, and he's landed his dream penciling gig. I mean, he's doing all the penciling and inking because nobody just pencils anymore. But he, this is like his dream. Okay. Like for 30 years, I've only heard him wanting to do this, and he's doing it. And it's amazing. And he's like, I am dying. It is so hard. And I'm like, yeah, you're doing what we could do at 25 with very little effort, 14 hours. Long day, but you can do it, and you can go to bed and you can get up and go back and do it again. Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah man. Well, I mean, I'm happy for him, but yes.
Oh, me too. Like, I can't like say enough, and I haven't said I just keep texting him or writing him, and I'm like, I just can't tell you how absolutely happy I am for you, how jealous I am for you. You know, but then like my mind is going, it would be a nightmare. I've run that scenario through my head in the last, you know, doing this podcast, you know, dipping my toe in the comic industry again, just sort of on this, like, you know, verbal level. I go, what would happen if I'm like, I would just fall apart. Like, it is so physically brutal to draw a comic book. It's like a combat sport.
It's so weird because I would never have a desk job. I would never be sitting in a cubicle all day. Like, that's crazy. That's for the fucking
squares.
Like, that is
8 hours a day.
That is what I do. Yeah, exactly. I sit for 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
Hunched over
a rectangle. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have a little mat that I stand on.
Oh, okay.
So I stand for 5 hours and then I sit for five
right.
hours, maybe,
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
uh-huh.
yeah, of course, this all day long. It's crazy.
It's the weirdest thing. And like, I mean, you know, I'm wearing readers because I can't see anything that's within reading distance anymore. That isn't just sort of a blur. And I'd never had to wear any glasses, and I would find myself, my nose was just right above the page, you know, drawing, like, and I would have to pull back, give yourself some space. God. It was,
I know.
And your neck, all that stuff. It's just,
I had back problems. Like, I still have back stuff.
Yeah.
But like, I was sitting poorly enough that I had, you know, pinched a nerve in my back. I had to go to the hospital for like steroids and physical therapy and stuff. Like,
Was this what Leonardo...
The saddest injury.
Was Da Vinci saying this stuff? Was he back in the day going like, oh, my back?
Yeah, yes. Oh, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I like to think that we've lost some sort of ancient wisdom of how to make art and not be in pain.
Yeah, I know.
I don't think it's true. I think it's always been a painful act.
Now we just live long enough that we can like deal with the pain.
We're not dying.
Like, actually be in pain instead of like, yeah, exactly.
Sure. Oh, man. So,
which is also good.
Yeah. So where I mean, are you? Are you in New York?
I'm in New York. Yeah.
Whereabouts?
Yeah. Yeah. I live outside the city up in Beacon.
Okay. Yeah, dude. Beacon's great.
It is. We moved up from Brooklyn about a year ago.
Okay.
And it's taken me a little bit of getting used to be fair. My wife loves it. Like, has loved it from the jump, but like, there's a lot to love.
Mm-hmm.
I miss the city sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
I don't miss the city sometimes. You're in New York too, right?
Well, no, I was. So I lived in New York City for 25 years. And
okay.
Yeah. And then 12 years ago ish, I don't know, we moved from New York to Asheville. And so I relate to the whole, everyone's like, oh, you must love it. I'm like,
Sure.
Yeah.
Like how much do you want to really get into that?
It's like the first thing I think that it's the food thing is the first thing. That's the first thing that gets you. You go, oh my.
Yeah.
And listen, I'm going to just throwing it out there. I'll bet you the food on average in Beacon is probably better than around here. I know anybody from Asheville is like throwing their iPod across the room. People listen to iPods. iPod, no, it's not even a thing.
I don't think that's a thing anymore.
They're chucking their device of whatever choice across the room hearing me say that. But, we don't have a lot of ethnic food here. If you want like barbecue or something, but we don't have a lot of like, we can't even get good Chinese. I haven't found, so, and to me that seems to be a basic
Asheville
necessity.
Does have like, 100%. Yeah, man, you got to have a good Chinese takeaway that you could walk to. You got to have, like a falafel spot.
Oh, no. You've gone way too out there now, man.
Yeah. It's funny. It's not fun. I don't want to like complain. Beacon is close-ish to CIA, to Culinary Institute. Mm-hmm. And so like a lot of people are like, oh, man, the food must be amazing. And maybe it is, but like exactly like coming from Brooklyn and like I grew up in an Italian house. So like the Italian food I cook at home.
Right.
So like all the Italian restaurants that are on Main Street, I don't care about.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is Haitian. And so like we can't find any of those foods unless she cooks it or her mom cooks it. And then like you said, just living in the city. Yeah. Like the Chinese takeaway, the like my ramen spot, my falafel spot, the halal guys. I'm like, yeah, man.
Yeah.
There is actually in Beacon Main Street, if anyone's listening and lives in Beacon, there is a Tibetan spot on Main Street called Momo Valley, which is awesome. And that's like my go-to spot whenever people come in from anywhere else.
Right. It's like you get your one move. It's your one dance move and you bring them over and you're like.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like, I bet you don't know this food.
Yeah.
So let's go here. Yeah.
Right. Words never uttered in Asheville. Hey, how about Ethiopian tonight?
Yeah.
Not going to happen. I drove 45 minutes on Sunday to go have Thai food with a friend. That's how like, and outstanding Thai food, A+, Northern Thai cuisine. Good, yeah. You know, there's no sort of, you know, chicken with basil sauce on this menu. It's a completely unique and great, phenomenal food. Awesome. But it was a 45 minute drive like into the wilds, not heading towards like Charlotte. It was really interesting. So, but worth it.
Well, that's good. Sometimes that's fun, but it's a destination.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not. Cause like I said, I want to walk places
too.
I feel like Asheville has like a good food reputation.
I think it does.
Maybe not. It's been on like TV shows.
Listen, it's unfair. I'm judging it against New York City, which is not fair for any.
Well,
yeah, you know, but
anywhere. Yeah,
I'm really speaking mostly about having a variety of foods from different cultures around the world, which to me makes going out fun. Otherwise, like I have to say, okay, well, I'm going to just learn to cook better Indian food, and that's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love to cook, but I don't want to learn how to cook better Indian food. Mm. I want to go to an Indian restaurant or to my friend's house.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I do like to cook, but there's certain things where I'm like, no, man, I want you. I want the person who grew up with that food mm-hmm. to make it, because I will never make it better than that.
Yeah.
So just, yeah.
So you grew, did you grow up in Brooklyn or did you grow up elsewhere?
No, I grew up in Virginia.
Oh, Virginia. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So I grew up in Richmond, left when I was about 18. I lived a bunch of places. I moved to Australia and I went to college and university in Australia for a while, or for university, and then lived there for a little while afterwards. And then I lived in London. I lived on the West Coast. I lived in LA and in San Francisco, and then New York for
so dodging most recently. Dodging taxes or wait what why all
over I wish it was something romantic. I guess that's not romantic. Something like dramatic. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I go back to Richmond now, and it's actually awesome. Like
that's what I hear.
It's we're talking about like the food scene is super strong. The comic book scene is super strong. The music scene has always been strong. The art scene, VCU, the Virginia Commonwealth University, sure. which is a university downtown, has such a strong art program that within the past, I don't know, I feel like 20 years now, I guess I'm not so young anymore, Richmond as a city has really changed because there's people coming there from all over the place, creative people coming mm-hmm. there from all over the place. So food, music, art, everything is like, pretty high quality. But having said that, growing up there, it's still the South. And when I was after I graduated high school, I was like, I don't want to be here for a number of reasons, like social and political reasons. Like I don't want to be here anymore. And I have the opportunity to not be here. So, I mean, it's funny, like Australia is like geographically the furthest away I could have gone before I start to come back again. So yeah, just, you know, being able to, I appreciate how fortunate I am, like that I was able to do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, 18, I was able to get into a school and then get myself out there for a little while.
That's amazing. I mean, I went to school in New York City from growing up in Connecticut, and that, yeah, I'm like, okay. Like, I feel like I'm far away. I mean, but like, yeah. It takes a lot to like conceive of an absolute change in everything. Cause there's no, I mean, the only thing you didn't have to learn was the language, so to speak. You could at least communicate.
Right.
That is a huge culture shift.
Yeah.
What was the impetus? I mean, I'm just so curious, like what the impetus for that would have been.
It truly was like, I don't want to be in Virginia. I don't want to be in the South.
Right.
And I don't particularly feel any affinity to the country, like to the United States a place. So, and again, it was really just like, why not? I appreciated that. I'm like, I'm young now. Now is the time to do these kind of crazy things. I have zero responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And I could sort of sell my family on it by going to school.
Right.
Like you know, again, I realize how privileged I am. You know, my family had been able to put money aside for my brother and I to go to university. And so it was like, okay, well, if you can get yourself there and like keep yourself there, then you have a little bit of money for school.
Right.
So, you know, got into school, was able to get there and work there and, you know, maintain myself. So, and then it was just like, at that point, you have that sort of bug. So it's like, after that, like, why am I going to come back to Virginia or any place. So then it was just like, well, let me sort of travel and do different things and meet different people and have all these different experiences. Mm-hmm. And genuinely it was really just because why not?
Yeah. No. I mean, I think it's amazing. And I mean, for almost every one of my nieces and nephews, I just was always crossing my fingers. I'm like, just go to school outside of state, just go somewhere outside of your home state, find somewhere else, because I always just felt that that was a way for them to find themselves a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You learn a lot.
Yeah, no, that's true. I didn't go far enough away that I couldn't sneak home and do laundry. That was my flaw in my breakaway plan.
Well, that's important too.
Yeah, but with free food and laundry, so like, I mean, like, that was a pretty good call. So, did you go there for art studies, or were you
my origin story, I guess I've told this before, but like I was arrogant enough in high school that thumbs up on that the app arrogant enough in high school that I didn't feel like I needed to go to art college. I didn't need to go to art school because I was, you know,
you were the best in the class, right?
I was the best drawer. Sure. Yeah, exactly. I was voted the best artist or most artistic. I can do all this.
I'll just bring that to the editor of a magazine and just say
100%.
There you go.
Yeah. Like, yeah, here's my yearbook.
Right.
So arrogance plus, I actually did have the opportunity in my senior year to make a comic book. And it's funny. It's sort of the situation your friend is in now, but I was a kid, was like, this is fucking hard. So can I swear?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this is hard. Like, this is real work. And I didn't have the experience, certainly, or like the maturity to be like, right, this is a job, even though I enjoy it. This is work. This is a job. So that sort of artistic arrogance plus the experience of this is too hard for me at 17, 18 was like, I don't want to study art. Mm. I'll do something else because I want art for me. My grandfather was an artist for himself. It's a number of things, you know, it was a different time. He was an immigrant. It was a bunch of things where he couldn't pursue art, but it was always, you know, it was art for himself because if it became a job, then he wouldn't enjoy it anymore. And for me, that was always in the back of my head as like a fear.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's okay. I always enjoyed storytelling and literature. So I'm like, I'll go and I can study literature and maybe I'll write or I'll teach or I'll still have sort of maybe a toe in a creative space but very shortly after deciding that I couldn't be a professional artist, I realized I needed, for me personally, to be a professional artist. it was the thing that always made sense and what truly brought me the most joy. And the fear of like, well, what if it becomes a job and then you don't love it anymore was for me very quickly sort of put to the side in that like, well, if you love it, then you find that joy as it becomes a job. You find the aspects of it that you still enjoy, or you just tough it out for that day or that week or whatever, or three ors, I guess. But I've always been the kind of person who's I guess all in, or, you know, leap before I look kind of thing, because I've always had the confidence that, I'm 100% committed to this thing. Mm-hmm. And if the thing doesn't work out, I have zero ego about, well, that didn't work. So now I'm just going to shift somewhere else. And again, when you're young, that's a little easier. But I mean, that's really a driving force to me too, is I'm committed to this one thing. If it doesn't work, then I move past that and I commit to the next thing, whatever that is. And there have been plenty of things that I have committed to that for one reason or another that don't work. And then you're like, well, again, like there's no ego. This did not succeed.
Yeah.
And now I move on to the next thing.
Yeah. It's tough to, it is hard. I mean, because I think creativity, we were saying earlier, I mean, but it is a very, because it's such a personal act, it is ego driven. Like there's this whole ego aspect, and you have to learn to manage, you know, the realities of the actual world of it versus your internal ego needs that are screaming and yelling for one thing or another. And you go, well, okay, settle down. Like, we can't go do this, or we have to go do this, or it's okay that didn't work out and that, or that wasn't a big thing. Like you can figure it out. You can move on through. It's like an identity thing. Like I'm really, you know, if you can, I always try to think of like, if you wonder why people do act the way they do at times, you know, the confusing things, you go, why? And then I go, okay, well, if you can remove like money from the equation, what is the reasoning for their doing this? Because and then you go, oh, okay, so like the idea for them, it's money or it's attention or whatever the thing is. And I think that that identity and wrapping yourself into whatever the thing you do is a really, you know, slippery slope.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I read a book, I reread this book often. I wish I could remember the author, called The War of Art.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Stephen J. Pressfield.
Thank you. Yes. So there's a passage in there that has always stuck with me, and it's something that I keep in mind that I'm not still very good at, but the idea of the identity of the artist, and that it's such a modern phenomenon that we, in this creative space, identify as the artist. Because if your identity is wrapped up in whatever you do, then if you don't do that well, or if you are not doing that, then you have no identity.
Mm-hmm.
And then you struggle with any sort of sense of self.
Right.
And specific to the art or to the visual arts, if I'm not creating something, if I'm not working on something that is coming out the way I want it to, then I'm a bad artist and then I'm a bad person. Or if I'm not working on anything at all, then what am I at all?
Yeah, you're unworthy.
And which sounds crazy to people on the outside. And to me, even, like, I recognize that this is a very unhealthy thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly something that I have struggled with.
Yeah, and I don't.
My talk of no ego, you know, aside, like that is something that I've struggled with.
Yeah, sure. And everyone I know struggles with it, whether they discuss it or not, to what level. Mm-hmm. One thing I do, maybe 5 years ago, I started doing. I stopped. You know, when you're at a party with people and you meet someone, and you're like, oh, well, what do you do? You know, I've stopped doing that because it's like,
yes.
who wants to talk about their work to begin with? Right. So I say, what do you like to do when you're not working? Like, that's my question. I ask people, because I'm like, at least this is an opening for them to be interested in what they're talking about versus, yeah, I do a job and I don't like my job, you know, like,
yeah,
oh, well, let's talk more about that, Ted. Well,
yes. No, I completely agree. I think that's a very American thing too. I've talked to some of my friends who grew up in different countries, and the what do you do for work is culturally not really a question.
Right.
Like, it's more exactly what you're saying. Like, what do you do? Oh, I hike and I fish and I, you know, my grandkids come and we go play this game that they invented.
Yeah.
It's never, what do you do? I'm an accountant.
Right.
And I pay and I do taxes for my community. Like,
yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah. I love my creative out. I love my creative. I like my creative work. I like my creative outlets. But if a giant truckload of money dropped on my lap, I'd be like, I have so many interests and hobbies. I'd be like, I would never look back. I'm like, yeah, that's great. I'm going to go hike the AT. There you go.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't care.
I know. Now with this baby in the house, we're talking about, maybe we should start playing the lottery.
Yeah. Right.
Just to have that. Yeah, that'd be cool to have that kind of money. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Exactly. Go hiking money. That's what I like to call
do.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Although I will be fair, I don't know if I would not do this.
I know. Well, that's the thing. I can recall so many sort of, you know, sort of fantasies, and they all start with, like, you know, when I was getting into the design world, I'm like, oh, I'd open up my own agency. So you would just work. You're already working. Like, that was my, like, okay, cool. Because clearly I just want to do a thing that I like to do.
Yes. Yeah. If I had the means, then I would give myself more work to do.
Yeah, exactly. I could do all the things. I would
start an agency, or I would, exactly. I would.
I'd start a book, I start a book imprint, and then I would, and I'm like, okay, so now you've just given yourself like four jobs. Good job.
Yeah.
So good job, exactly. You said you had an opportunity to do comic as a 17-year-old.
Mm.
How did that happen?
So my high school had the option for the seniors, if they wanted it, to do a senior project, mm-hmm. we called it. And most people would, you know, take an internship or I guess that's pretty much it. Like, do some independent study, mm-hmm. internship, part-time job, whatever, in the field that presumably they wanted to pursue. And there was the journalism teacher at my school was a comic book fan and had written this fantasy story when he was in high school. And we were friends. And so I was like, oh, let's make a comic book. And, you know, I pitched it to whoever needed to approve it. And so it, you know, then we did it. Like I said, it was hard work, and it's just, it is literally, I don't even know, maybe 12 pages mm-hmm. of swipes from Joe Mad right. and the Kubert brothers and who else was I like reading at the time? You know, Mark Silvestri mm-hmm. And all the guys, and well, probably exclusively guys at that point that I was like mimicking at that mm-hmm. point are in there.
Yeah.
Just with like slightly different,
just
like robe on or something.
Right. They're wearing
or
maybe different not clothes. Even.
Yeah. 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 So yeah. And it was, I penciled inked and colored it with colored pencils. And then the writer, I think, had lettered it. I can't even remember now. My mom has a bunch of them yeah. still, and they're awful and sort of fun now to sure. look through, but bad. And yeah, again, like discouraging enough that it was like, I don't know if I can do this.
Right. Yeah.
Which was surprising for an arrogant kid.
Yeah.
And humbling for sure.
I get it. I mean, I don't even know. Like, I mean, I'm thinking about it, you know, yeah, I did comic book pages probably starting in, you know, junior high through high school, just kind of my own, but like, it was only a page, you know, maybe two, you know, it was like this or that, lots of copying, lots of original drawing, lots of, you know, figure drawing, all that kind of stuff, painting, whatever. Mm. And then I go off to art school and they kind of gave us a year of like foundation. And then they're like, okay, now time to do comic books, you know? And we're like, oh boy, can't wait. You know? And I'm like, I didn't really know what to do. Like, I understood storytelling to a degree. I understood composition to a degree, like all this stuff, but right. there really wasn't an sort of a 1, 2, 3, 4. I had the How to Draw Comics the Marvel way. That was like,
of course,
that was the thing that I probably learned the most from. And then it was just sort of lots of trial and error. And then having your teacher go, nope, 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 nope.
Yeah.
And then you go, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
eventually it like sinks in. Yeah, that How to Draw Comics the Marvel way, obviously I have that. We all have that.
Yeah.
But like, that's also like unlearning some of that stuff, mm-hmm. for me at least, like as you become a professional, it's like, oh, that's how John Buscema did it.
Mm-hmm.
John or Sal? I think it's
yeah, John.
John
Buscema, yeah.
And so I can definitely do that top-down view of Captain America punching.
Yeah.
But is that the appropriate panel for every time I need to throw a punch? Like, no, right. You need to figure out like what he's actually teaching, not just for me.
Right. Rather than regurgitation.
Pulling from the,
yeah.
Which is tough.
No, yeah. It's, well, it's the difference between teaching, like I taught at a design school, an advertising school, and there was a competing school. The reason VCU was actually one of these schools that was making their bones when I was teaching at the school. And we were like, damn them, you know, cause they were winning all these awards in the late '90s. And, but the other school in Atlanta was this real spit and polish school. Like people left that school with these beautiful portfolios. Like it looked like they were agency works. And our school, they weren't that quality of a portfolio, but the thinking was so good. And the tenet of that school was, we want to teach the people to become the best thinkers they can be. Because awesome. If you can solve a problem, all that other stuff is technique. You can learn technique on the job, but you can't really learn how to think on the job in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I completely agree with that. I tell young people now, like, again, having not gone to art school, the technique that I have, I feel like I have come to it the hardest way possible, but just through doing it myself. But the benefit of that is so many people who come through an art school or a design program will have that polish because they are repeating their professors.
Sure.
Or whomever, like whatever their influences are, which is maybe, I mean, I'll be honest, like maybe a good way to get work because that's what is a professional level of work.
Yeah.
But as far as critical thinking or creative thinking rather, and like a sense of design style, whatever you want to say, that's gotta be self-generated. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because it's the only true voice you have.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and it takes time to get there. I mean, obviously you have to, you know, copy Joe Matt or whomever it is to get to that point. And you've got to put it all into the sponge and then squeeze out whatever that kind of that muck that comes out eventually becomes your thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The widest range of influences that you can.
Mm-hmm.
And then exactly like distill it into your voice.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And like, and that thing is like, especially for comics, like don't have your main influences be comic book people.
Oh yeah.
Try to go everywhere you can to get as much as you can to be able to bring back to the medium something different, because otherwise everybody ends up looking very similar, you know? And I think it's not bashing because I love all the sources right now, but we're in a period of, you know, Bruce Timm, you know, Mike Mignola and manga of some sort. Like these styles have so much impact in the volume of people creating artwork right now that it's, And I recuse myself from the situation with the manga because I don't have as sharp of an eye to differentiate between, you know, the breadth of artists there.
Right.
But I want to see people doing a little bit less of a Mike Mignola world. And I want to see them do something a little unique. And I want to see Mike Mignola stuff, but not where I can go, oh, that's Mignola. Yeah,
100%. No, I want to see Mike do it. I don't need to see a watered down version. Right. As much as I love that design sense and storytelling, I have seen it, and I don't need to see your interpretation of it.
Yeah,
whoever's coming up. I think I agree with you. I think that in mainstream superhero comics, there has been a little bit of a reversion to house style the past maybe 5 or 10 years or so. And my personal theory is that with the superhero films being so popular, in order to bring you went and saw a Spider-Man movie or the Avengers movie, like, come now read the comic book. The comic book has to look like a comic book. It's not the days of Vertigo or Tundra anymore. It's got to look polished and shiny and muscly and superhero-y. It's got to. Whereas at the same time, the younger generation is so influenced by the mangaka and the manga that they're reading that they're only regurgitating, frankly, like our Western interpretation mostly of what the artists in Japan are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, there's kind of a look to comic books if you're on the outside there's a look that people from the outside associate with comic books. But I think from the inside, it's up to us who are making comic books to insist that it can be, that it can look and be anything.
And this is just how it is. When you have a publishing house and you have properties that have value, there is an expectation from the publishers that the books look a certain level of quality. They don't have to look the same stylistically, but I can recall having a conversation with an editor who I was trying to, you know, get some work with. And I said, what do I have to do to get you to, you know, put me on a book? He's like, well, draw like Joe Quesada. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, so because you can bring that into your meeting. And people go, we know we can sell this because Joe sells. So anything that looks like Joe will sell.
Unfortunately, I have had two instances in my sort of coming up like that where I one before I was published at all, I was at a convention where I think my portfolio was at a level where other artists were starting to consider like, oh, I might be able to introduce you to somebody to editorial. And there was one artist who was on a very big book at the time who was like, this stuff is really good, but you know what you should do is like, look at who the top artists are and do that.
Right.
Yeah. Like incorporate that in, which again, is good business advice.
It's great business advice.
But even then, I was like, I don't, you know, I thanked him. I was like, I really don't want to do that
Right.
though. So I continued to not work professionally. And then when I was at Marvel, I was exclusive to Marvel for a couple of years, and I was doing work on the Dark Tower series, and I started to paint a little bit more. And editorial was great. Like when that project was coming to an end, they were like, "Hey man, this is tough to place. Like, if you sort of pull it back and do a little harder lines or like black and white, more superhero stuff, then you know it'll be a little easier to find you work." And again, I was like, "Man, that's I thank you. I don't think that I want to do that right now." And again, like they were upfront and honest, and I have no. There's no problem with that. But it was like, this is a voice, or this is a direction that I want to take for me, and a voice that I want to explore. And so that was kind of hard. It's hard to find a home for it sometimes, though.
I mean, it's hard to find a home because it's not a sure thing.
Hundred percent.
That's the
Yes.
issue. You know, if Alex Ross chose to have a different style for a thing, they'd still say, sure, go for it. I mean, and you can almost say that his Fantastic Four book that he did last year is a departure of style for him because it's not a fully painted piece. It's, you know, kind of, you know, pencil work, and it's a variety of stuff. But they already have a brand they can attach to. It's called Alex Ross. So,
Well, yeah, exactly.
you know, Bill Sienkiewicz, who is, I would say, the ultimate chameleon, is has what's, you know, 70,000 styles in his pocket. So they're selling Bill's ability to tell a story and execute at a high level, whatever the damn thing is.
Right. That's my like I don't know. I don't want to say North Star, but let's call it North Star. Like
Yeah.
Sienkiewicz is like
He's
that's what I
the greatest. He's the greatest painted comic book artist ever.
Dave McKean and Bill Sienkiewicz are what like the ideal career is for me for right now at least.
I mean Bill has his storytelling ability is rock solid, and it's so he's never sacrificing the story for the image. You know, so he is his first and foremost goal is to tell the story, and then, you know, and then he will design the page with his skill sets to make it visually interesting. And that is a, you know, and there are other people who I would say might even be better technically as painters. You know, like a John J. Muth is a brilliant watercolorist. You know, I mean, I can, but John doesn't have the same sort of ability of storytelling and dynamism that Bill does. Bill can blow you know, him. Okay, yeah, I can do that.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. That storytelling versus image
Yeah.
is something I still struggle with too.
Sure.
Because yeah, I want to make the cool thing, make the cool image.
Yeah,
But
totally.
like it has to be in service to something bigger than just a cool image.
Right. Which is really tough because especially,
It is.
you know, I and you know we and you're sort of your citations of comic book artists is the period of Image. You know, those, you know, that's when Image supplanted the need for, you know, Will Eisner's world of storytelling or Alex Toth's world of storytelling. And that's fine. Listen, MTV did it a decade before, you know, like it came in and it was just these quick cuts, and everybody was who liked visual storytelling was going, this is horrifying. And all the, you know, the young people are like, this is perfect, you know. So it's just evolution.
And looking back on it now, like the image revolution in comics specifically, I feel like it was like kind of a punchline for a little while. But now, like for me at least, whether it was successful as a storytelling or as a comic book sort of experiment or not, doesn't even matter because, like you said, it was different and it was challenging. And like, yeah, some of the artistic choices were bonkers, but comics didn't look like that before. It influenced a literal generation of people, you know, and changed the visual language
It changed
of
the
American comic books
industry.
100%.
It changed the industry. It went from an industry of publishers controlling stories and printing for creators to creators doing what they wanted to do. Who cares whatever they were doing? They were doing what they wanted to do at the highest level of attention. And they paved the way for everybody who said, oh, I want to do that too. And then they built a mechanism called Image Comics, which opened the door for all these creators, hundreds and hundreds of creators, to publish their books at the, I mean, listen, they make the best printed floppy comics in the industry right now, print wise, production wise, perfect. And they make these beautiful books and distribute them around the, you know, the world. And that didn't exist.
Yeah.
So
amazing.
They should be enshrined just for that action.
Yeah.
And then they hired all their heroes, which I thought was amazing. They turned around, they said, okay, well, we're going to hire all these people who we think are amazing to do stuff with us.
Yeah. Well, the second generation of image artists was the most interesting to me because I, like, artistically, I'll be honest, like the first, the image founders weren't all my favorite artists, but then that second wave or third or whatever it was, where it was then, that's like Sam Keith and
Travis,
Travis Schrey. What am I thinking of? This is terrible for a podcast. No, anyway, Jay Lee.
Oh, Jay, sure. Yeah.
And it's like, this is blowing my mind now because this is still kind of superheroes, but it's kind of not. And there's weird voices that are being seen and like awesome stuff.
Oh, it was great. I mean, listen, you know, they're, you know, Todd hired Greg Capullo, you know, pulled him away from, you know, and Greg came and just knocked out of the park and then, you know, sort of made himself into the superstar that he, you know, I saw when he was doing, what was it? Was a Nova or whatever the book, you know, it wasn't Nova. It was doing one of these, the space comics for Marvel.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody cared about that comic book. No. He goes off and goes and does, you know, does this, you know, run on Spawn, comes back. He's the man. And now he's Mr. Batman.
He's my Spawn artist. I associate Spawn with Capullo visually more than Todd, which is, seems crazy, but yeah, exactly. Like,
and they discovered like freaking Aaron Weisenfeld. I don't know if you remember Aaron Weisenfeld.
I've got the three comics he ever did.
The three,
on my shelf over there.
Like all amazing. Of them are perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Unbelievable.
Yeah. He's
a fine artist now. He's a painter.
Beautiful.
He does gallery stuff. Now,
super creepy and beautiful. Love it.
Very unsettling. Some of it.
Yeah. He's great. I'm so happy for him. So all right, so I mean, clearly the passion is there for comic books, and you love it. Like, how did you when did you say like, hey, I'm gonna chase after this, or was it a fortune thing, or was it, you know?
No, I like I said, like shortly after deciding I don't want to do anything with art, I realized I do want to do something with art, and then it was sort of, well, I wanna. You know, again, I was young. I want to tattoo and I want to design shoes and I want to be in galleries and I want to draw comics and I want to design characters for, I don't know, like I never played video games, but like I'll design video games. Like I want to do everything. And then eventually realizing that's not how it works for me, at least. Like I can't do that. I need to do one thing and then see what branches come from that. And comics was always the, like, you know, it's your first love. Storytelling is always something that I loved. And comics, I still have the first comic I ever bought and like remember pretty well the impact
it
had on me. It's a reprint of a Paul Smith X-Men. Ooh. It's an X-Men classic. I can't remember the number, but it's the Kitty Pryde in the Morlock Tunnels where Warren Worthington gets his wings clipped by Callisto. Oof. And
Brutal.
And it's Paul Smith art, and I'm almost positive it's one of the it's Claremont.
Yes, yeah, he's writing it for
during
sure.
the Claremont run, yeah. And it was like, I swear, I picked it up for no reason at all. The reprint had Nightcrawler on the cover,
okay,
which is cool. And then it was just like, what is this? And then reading it, and then in school, like as a little kid, like, you know, trading comics and seeing my friend got this Spider-Man thing, or like, this guy's mom doesn't know that he has Venom comics. Like, whoa, or like Spawn, or you know, whatever. Right, not Spawn yet, but so yeah, so that was like basically that love was the first love, and then eventually realizing, you know, post high school that this is a job and I can still love it and I can pursue it. It was really just like buckling down and like, okay, I'll get my portfolio together and I'll send it off and then I'll be a comic book artist because again, I'm very good at drawing.
Of course. So you're better than, yeah, anyone else in your class.
Yeah, exactly. So this will be fine. I was saying this on another podcast recently too, where I was like, I remember pretty well, like, committing to being a comic book artist, doing new pages. Like, I knew that my old stuff wasn't good, so I'm going to do a new samples. And then this was long enough ago that it was physically, you know, putting them in envelopes and being like, oh, shit, like, I don't want to send the Dark Horse one first because they're going to give me work. And if I send the Marvel one first, then they're probably going to get – and obviously, I didn't get any responses from anybody because it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, the mailman mustn't have delivered it. That's probably what happened.
Exactly. I think it was during that time Marvel stopped taking unsolicited submissions.
Right,
that's
right.
The only explanation.
Maybe they moved offices and it went to the old office.
Perhaps there. Yeah. I don't remember when they went when they moved out to California. Or yeah. So anyway, So just that. Wasn't a huge blow, but it was definitely like, oh, okay, like a little humbling, and then mm-hmm. and then yeah, just committing to it, working to improve,
yeah,
enough that, like I said, you get to the point where my entry was really just doing those samples over and over again, going to conventions, mm-hmm. showing them to the artists who I admired, getting critiques. Doing it again in 6 months or in a year, and then doing and the same with editors until eventually it was like, yeah, this is not terrible. And again, like you were saying earlier, like mitigating that risk of like, this is a business, we can't lose money on you. This is of a quality that we're probably not going to lose money, so you're invited mm-hmm. in.
Yeah,
it's like the least romantic way to say it.
No, but that's what it is.
Reality. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
No, it was a year and a half, I was in college at the time, but year and a half of just every other week going into the offices with my pages and mm-hmm. getting critiqued and, you know, hearing all the, you know, the words, you know, this, that, and the other thing. You go, okay. And you go make your changes on new pages. And then you come back. And then eventually, you know, the funny thing is it comes back to, so I was talking to someone yesterday about getting work. And the question was like, how do you get work in this thing? How do you get work in that thing? And I'm like, I don't know how the traditional way works because I've never gotten work the traditional way. I've only gotten work the way of building the soft network of people and building the trust and sort of reliance and confidence in the people to the point where someone, if you can get someone to vouch for you, well, then that takes care of all these other things. And yeah. That's what it comes to. And it's not that the work wasn't there. It's just like, I never got work sending something in. I never sent a portfolio in somewhere. And then they're saying, well, we want you to do the thing. It was always just reference.
Yeah. I think I'm the same. I'm trying to think now. I don't know if I've ever gotten the email back. That's like, I like this. Let's do this next thing.
I got a job. I got a job on my portfolio. Like literally full-time job. And I never, ever submitted my portfolio to that company. I have no idea how.
Amazing. Yeah.
My wife called and said, hey, somebody called from this place. And I'm like, I have no idea what that is. And I called and she was like, oh yeah, I looked at your portfolio and, you know, we really like it. You want to come in? And I was like, sure.
Yes.
Where are you?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
It was great and it saved my bacon, but it was one of those weird, you know, I think it, cause it was even too early to be online. It was like 2004.
Yeah.
Or three.
Oh, that's wild.
I don't know.
I wonder if, I mean, someone must have.
Yeah.
Someone's looking out for you.
Like that was
showed it to someone who showed it to someone. Yeah.
Some angel.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah. Also, yeah.
So you, I mean, but you did it, I guess, you know, that sort of old fashioned ish way. You were, you know, hustling yourself, you know, and putting yourself in front of people.
Yeah. That's like the only way that I knew how. Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as I love comics, I didn't know anyone in the industry, or even I think any professional artists in any industry.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that made sense to me was, just to do the thing and then show it to people who are the industry.
Right. What was the confidence level? Like, cause you were saying like, we were talking super high. So it was, always remained pretty high.
Still high.
Okay.
I think that I always loved the Venn diagram of the artist as, you know, the two circles are, like an unchecked egomaniac and crippling self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist is the overlap
right.
between those two. Which I do believe, and I've always said this to myself and to other artists or people who want to break into anything creative, like whatever doubts you have about your ability and your work, keep that shit to yourself when you're talking about your work.
Yeah, lock that shit down.
Yeah, like because it does no one any good. Nope. If I want to work with you to be like, hey, like this is the kind of work I do, and I, you know, I know that this here wasn't quite the way I wanted it to do, but I think I'm learning and this panel, I was so rushed. Who gives a shit? Shut up.
You're right.
Like, first of all, if I'm showing my work to someone and it's not been commissioned or like a job already, then it means I've taken as long as I wanted to take on it. So if there's any mistakes there, it's inexcusable.
Mm-hmm.
But also like if you're presenting yourself, you have to present yourself with confidence.
Mm-hmm.
without arrogance. So in spite of like comics being hard and me realizing that, oh, I'm not the best artist in the world, confidence was always high enough that I was comfortable showing my work and getting critiques too, because my work was always at a level where the critique wasn't abroad, like, well, you know, you should probably work on your anatomy and your storytelling.
Yeah, right.
Which means everything is terrible.
Right. Have a nice day.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It was a little bit, even if it was only a little bit more specific, it was a little bit more specific, which was always like empowering to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too, like I truly love this world and this medium.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the people that I was engaged with could see that. I was literally at the convention, like taking notes in my sketchbook with like how, you said to do this, I'll blah, 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 blah. And I think that that's like, oh, okay, cool. Like I can give you, or, you know, the other artists, like to me, I can give you an extra 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Or I can give you like some genuine advice. And then again, like for me, it was like, cool. I, in 6 months at the next show or in a year at the next show, it's like, oh, hey, like I'm Jonathan. I met you last year. I'm sure you don't remember, but like you were super insightful. I've done some more work. Can I show you again? And most of the time it's like, oh my God. Yeah.
You came truly, back.
I'm sure they don't remember, but like, that's show me how you've improved.
Mm-hmm.
So the confidence was always high enough that I didn't worry about showing the work and getting the critiques. Less, you know, it's not super fun all the time. And I remember a couple cons where, again, with Marvel, I don't know if they do this. I don't know if they take submissions at all anymore, but they used to do a like drop off submission.
Yeah, and I remember
they would
that.
Post at the end of the day. Yeah, like these are the artists we want to meet tomorrow. And, you know, I didn't get called up a bunch of times. And that sucks. Like that's like I couldn't even meet you.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, that was hard,
yeah.
But you know, whatever. Then you're like, well, fine. Then I'm going to go to Artist Alley and I'm going to talk directly to whoever's here.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That doesn't have a crazy line, or I'll stand in line and then, you know, So high enough that I was comfortable doing it.
I used to mislabel it, and I still do, as not confidence, but the lack of self-awareness to not do it. Like, I would just be like, oh yeah, of course I'm just going to take this and I'm going to go there, or I'm going to call these people and say, I want to come into your office and take your time to show you my stuff. You know, not recognizing that this is a huge imposition and a low prospect kind of thing. But I think it's that level of connection, even if it were a phone call, because it was phone calls back then, of showing some enthusiasm, showing this interest. And then I guess, you know, I don't have a memory of it specifically, but I think just shutting the fuck up when they open your book to look at your samples, and just let them do their thing. Because some people like to flip through the pages and then go back and talk about it. Some people like to talk about panel to panel. They're, open your mouth it's a cardinal sin.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I, as a published working artist recently, like within the past 2 years, had some submissions in with editorial for at a book publisher, at a big book publisher who I would love to work with. And I finally got a response back with a couple notes, and I responded like an idiot to those notes to justify my choices. And I did not hear back. And as soon as I sent it, I was like, that might have been a mistake. Right. And a fucking course it was. Mm-hmm. And I did not speak to that editor again for a full year.
Right.
Because, like, they don't care why I did what I did. Mm-hmm. It was wrong to them or for the project or whatever. Shut up. Mm-hmm. Like, it was wrong.
Thank you for your time. Do something
else. Or yeah, exactly. So it's like, yeah, but I did it.
Yeah.
Nope.
Who cares?
Do not do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Who
because,
cares?
Listen,
who
everybody cares? Makes – everyone makes a gaffe. You know, I mean, you know, even Sienkiewicz will have a gaffe of a panel. That's okay, you know, but he's not going like, well, you know, I mean, he doesn't care.
Well, and I think that goes a long way.
Yeah.
And I will say too, like, I will happily admit too, that all this is just chat. Like, if you ask my wife, like, she'll come in here once in a while, or at the end of the day, I'll be like super down. And it's like, is everything okay? Like, yeah, it's just like, it was a hard day, like drawing. And she'll bust my balls too. Like, did the fucking shirt sleeve that you were drawing, like, was it tough?
Did your crayon break?
Yeah, exactly. And she's not mean about it at all, but it's like, yeah, you're right. That's an insane thing to have put me in such a bad mood that, like, yeah, I had a tough day drawing.
Yeah.
It'll be fine.
Right.
And it'll be fine tomorrow. Or I'll fix it. I redid a page yesterday because I didn't like the whole page. I mean, it was a splash. It was one image, but I did it last week. It's good. Mm-hmm. It's fine. It's something I enjoyed drawing, but I didn't love it. So I'll do it again. I'm not going to be stressed about, well, I mean, obviously I was stressed about it because I redid it, but like, it's like, well, just do it again. And that's not easy, but that is an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that subconscious that comes back a day or two later, and is just, you know, with the better solution. Yeah. You're like, where were you 2 days ago?
Yeah, and I'm still new enough, or young enough, or sensitive enough that, like, I do want everything I put out there, every page, every panel, to be the best. I can't. For me, I know I'm not Bill Sienkiewicz, and I cannot afford to be like, this is fine now, because not that he's like, this is fine because he doesn't care, but because the storytelling is spot on, or the next panel is perfect, or the project as a whole is exactly what he wants it to be. Whereas, like, for me, I'm like, yeah, but man, if like, what if this is in my head, you know, what if you see my book on the shelf and you flip it open and it is that one panel that wasn't very good. And then you're like, well, never mind.
I'm willing to give this guy one page chance. Yeah, and a random page, not even the first one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Wild.
So you were doing more traditional, I guess, comic book work getting into the business. Mm-hmm. So that was the sort of but were you only selling yourself as a penciler or inker, like doing your own artwork?
Just pencil it, really.
Oh, okay. So you were trying to do the pencil route at first.
100%. I'm trying to think, like, I started working with Aspen Comics was the first publisher that I worked with that published me. And I think that we shot straight from pencils for my first book. But this was like not that long ago. So like reproduction, you didn't really need the inks anymore. Mm-hmm. But I was at that point too, I was like penciling so tightly. I was light boxing my roughs to get them to a tighter rough to then light box onto the board.
Wow. So you were double roughing before you did your finished pencils.
It was, well, so before I was a tattoo apprentice before mm-hmm. I was like committed to the comics and in tattooing, you know, you build layers. Mm-hmm. You do this digitally now or traditionally, it's literally on tracing paper, mm-hmm. you know, like building shapes and then refining it. This is how sketching works like across the board. So that was in my head, is like, this is how you build form. But yeah, then for comics, it was like, well, build and then I'll do another layer, then I'll light box it. And at that point, it's like, man, I'm so tight. Why would I not just, instead of the pencil, literally just hold a pen? Mm-hmm. And then, and then again, it was like, stylistically, the stuff looks very different to what I'm doing now and to what I think is a more natural way for me to work. But it was very tight and very like meticulous. Mm-hmm. And then, as I started experimenting more, it got way more loose to the point where now it's I don't rough anything really. I have pretty competent thumbnails for myself, mm-hmm. but then the board itself is really just like a couple shapes to know where things go, and then it's straight in with the ink because that's more interesting and more sort of compelling for me.
Yeah, I think that I wonder what the source was, because I was super tight when I would pencil, and I think it was a control thing. Like I was so desperate to control what the outcome would be that if I drew every single feather of the render from, you know, black to white, then all the inker has to do is just do exactly what I drew right there, and it'll be perfect. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. I think that had a lot to do with it for sure. Yeah. And then like having a colorist as well, who's like,
oh, well, that's what the margins of the comic are for, or the board is to write in red notes. Pen, to write all the color notes. This is the way you become best friends. Oh, and don't forget, these are all the best tips. These are my best tips to become a top flight comic book penciler, folks. The other one is to draw in all the sound effects for your letterer. So if you follow all three of those things, you will be the best team player and they will love you for it.
Yeah. That's why now I do all of it myself, because I'm like probably not a great team player. I love to work with creative people who are not, I guess, going to contribute to the visuals at all, which is ego, just 100% ego.
Let me just say that spot varnish you put on the cover was fantastic.
But actually I'll take that back, because there are artists who I love to work with because I just love their work.
I think it was just a worry of me trying to match up with the people I identified with, and because clearly genius recognizes genius. So I must be over at that table for lunch. I'm still waiting for the invitation for the table.
Right. To the cool table. Yeah. To the genius table. Yeah. Totally. Same.
So what was the, like it was so funny. You were saying how like there's this, expectation of professionalism and that, you know, and that's the bar. And it's so funny because I remember like, my first experience of handing in my first assignments were, okay, great, thanks. Like there was no sitting down and going over the pages and doing that kind of stuff because, you know, as you said, this is what is expected. And it was an interesting sort of revelation of like, oh, okay, like I've been let in the door and they're not here to police me. They're not here to take care of my stuff because they got other things to do. I'm no longer a priority. Yeah. I'm just the person who's going to make their job easier or harder, depending on how I perform.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. No one's, there's very few pats on the back as you.
No, the attaboy, the attaboy.
Further along.
That's really what your peer group should be for. They're your attaboys, you know, like,
yeah.
Hey man, I really love what you did here. That's fantastic. That, you know, thanks for sharing this. Okay, great. Yeah, that should be enough for us, but you know.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, at this point, my peer group, like the cartoonists and the other artists that I hang out with, our text chain is all just telling each other how bad we are.
Nice hands.
Which is coming from a place of love, but like, man, you piece of shit. Like I saw that in fucking Dark Knight number 3. I know you swipe that like composition.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever. But
that's the thing. I think all of that sort of fraternal bashing, for lack of a better term, I think it's important, you know, because, you know,
yes,
we don't want to be so formal and be like, well, let's sit down and look at, because none of us want to think that we're superior to one another in the things that we do, but we also want everybody to be better at what they're doing, because I won't give you the time if I don't know you or care about you, but if I care about you, I'm going to give you all of my time. So
exactly,
like that's you know, the bad locker room behavior of that surrounds the effort at trying to improve one another's craft. It's all from a place of love.
It was. Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. We joke, me and my friends, like one of these days, someone's going to take it too far, but I don't know what that looks
what
like.
It's going to be.
So I guess we're just going to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the thing. So the book you shared with me, the new book, it's painted. Which is such a terrifying concept to me to say, to paint a comic book. What was your first sort of framing of like, I'm going to paint a comic book? I don't know if this is the first one, but I mean, when you first said I'm going to paint things.
Yeah, I think that like, again, growing or looking at art outside of comics and then looking at comics that were painted was like, revelatory to me, was super eye opening. And then studying guys like Sienkiewicz and Dave McKean, you know, Kent Williams, John J. Muth, George Pratt was a huge influence. Like guys who were challenging my idea of what comic books were. And then there were artists like Alex Ross who were like painting comics, but it still looked like comics, which is beautiful and amazing. But I was like, yeah, but what if it was like a little weirder, or what if it was a little exaggerated, because comics can be, you know, pushed in that direction. So I don't know. Yeah. I think that the impetus was really just, well, it had been done. Someone else has done this, so I can do this. And again, maybe that's some of the arrogance, not that I can do it as well.
No, I get it.
But that this exists already. I can do this. And then again, partly the control aspect, maybe, but like the stiffness of the comic book form is something I wanted to get away from. And the easiest way for me to get away from that is to take away those tight underdrawings, to move into a medium that literally flows, that moves depending on like how the angle that my table is on, to relinquish some of that control, to have like a more, I don't want to say artistic, but like a more emotional, you know, image.
No, I get that. I would say that there's a fair amount of expressionism kind of happening in the, you know, in the work, and then using the materials you're using, kind of a wabi-sabi sort of acceptance of like, it's going to happen.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess. Right. Okay, good.
It's 100%. I say this to people because it's mostly watercolor. It's watercolor, ink, oil. I mean, it's a bunch of things, but mostly watercolor. And the reason I like the watercolor so much is that wabi-sabi is like, genuinely, I have, let's say, 60% of the control over what my image is going to look like. And the other 40%, I like that it's going to do whatever it wants to do. And if I try to exert too much control, then it becomes stiff or muddy or shitty for any number of reasons. Yeah. And then you have to do it again or just struggle, like fight to get back to a point of sort of almost whimsy, like, oh, look at how free this image is.
Yeah.
It's either naturally that way because you are free to put that work down, or, you know, I worked for 12 hours to make this look like it was a casual, like a sure. brush stroke.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, like, I was, so a few years ago, we went to Sweden, we went to Anders Zorn's home and studio, and this guy,
oh cool,
you know, he's the Swedish John Singer Sargent, you know, and this guy,
of course,
you just look at Zorn's watercolors and Sargent's watercolors and you just go, how do you have so much control over light with this liquid? It's unbelievable. And you look at it and you can tell, listen, we're all, you know, CSI, you know, agents when it comes to looking at artwork, and you go, this guy didn't labor over this. He didn't try to lift. Yeah. He didn't try to lift anything up, and it's all put down, and it's there. The shapes are there. How? And there's no pencil. You're like, yeah.
What a piece of shit.
I know those fuckers.
Yeah, I mean that's. I feel the exact same way. There's certain artists that inspire, and there are certain artists that, I guess, intimidate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and often in the same sort of moment.
Mm.
But yeah, the watercolor masters are
it's the highest.
I don't.
It's the highest form.
And I don't know that it's like the fact that more people don't work in watercolor in comics makes sense because it is like it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
But like in a form or in a medium. Like comic books that is so reliant on emotion and motion and movement.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's so good.
Yeah.
Ink makes sense. It's, you know, there's nothing more graphic than black on white.
Mm-hmm.
But like the ink and the watercolor together for me was always just like, yeah, this is what I want. And I also like from a sort of practical standpoint, like you asked for maybe what the impetus, but, it was always important to me. Having said, you know, McKean and Sienkiewicz and all these influences, like it was important for me to be making comics that hopefully, if I'm doing my job well, eventually become recognizable as my
mm-hmm.
comics and my name. And like, even though it sounds shitty, like that brand
mm-hmm.
or that like artistic name to be like, oh, this looks like Jonathan. This looks like Bill. This looks like
sure.
McKean. You know, whatever.
But you guys have all very interesting last names, but your first names are all kind of really...
But very boring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
And you all... Yeah, Sienkiewicz is still probably the penultimate last name. But...
Oh, yeah. I have to look it up every time I write it.
Write it. Yeah, sure. I know. I'm like Googling. I put the wrong spelling in Google and it tells me the right 100%. Spelling every time. Yeah. But Berevecchia, that's a pretty... It's a good one too.
It's a good one. Yeah. Yeah. It's long.
Yeah. It's long. It's, yeah. I mean, I have so I have a 9-letter last name and I thought I had a long one. You're and here's how long your last name is. I go, I have a list of guests on like the website and I'm like, it's not going to fit on one line. Like your name is so long.
So in designing like the cover for the image book and for published work, it is genuinely sometimes a challenge to be like, this is going to look bad because it's so long.
Yeah.
You know, the writer on my image book on Bear Pirate is Sean Lewis, which is like a very nice, like it can be horizontal. We can stack them. We can do whatever we want.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, well, and then my name is the rest of the cover,
right?
Which is, I guess, fine. Like for my like, hey, look, it's me.
Look at me.
But, Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a memorable name. That's important. Yeah. I think it's important to have a memorable name.
Sure.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Take that, Bob Smith. No, and I think it's, I mean, listen, I think it's cool. So how did the book come about for you?
We, so Sean and I met online. We are neighbors, which we did not know.
All right.
I told you at the beginning, like I had just moved to Beacon. I don't live in Beacon. I live in the next town.
Okay.
So Sean and I connected because I had done a sketch cover, and I posted on Instagram for his last book that he did, called Above Snakes, which is a Western, sort of revenge, like a surrealist revenge story. It's very good. And I liked it. And I did a little sketch cover and I posted and I tagged him, and then he reached out or I sent it to him or something. So we were talking online and, you know, what kind of work do you like? And, you know, what's your schedule like? And we should do something and blah, 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 blah. And then I was like, well, you know, like, said, I live in New York. Do you live in New York? Because in my mind, why not? Maybe.
Yeah.
He's like, I do live in New York, but I don't live in the city anymore. I just moved, like upstate. I'm in the Hudson Valley. It was right after we moved. I was like, oh, no way. Like I just moved out of the city. Mm-hmm. I live in the Hudson Valley too. Where do you live? He's like, oh, I live in Beacon. I said, I just moved to Beacon too. That's crazy. We should meet up. He's like, well, I don't live in Beacon. I live in the next town over, which no one knows.
Right.
It's called Fishkill. And I was like, I also lied. And I live in Fishkill too. So we're neighbors. Like we truly, he's walked to my house. We live like a mile away.
That's from hilarious.
Town. Amazing. So I was like, okay, well, this is silly. Like, let's just go get a beer and hang out. Mm-hmm. So we did and sort of connected. And Sean is great. I was listening to your interview with Caitlin Yarsky from a little ways back, where she talks of Sean as well. He's very interested in that collaborative aspect of the comic book making and in finding a language that fits for both of us.
Yeah.
And so for Sean and I, you know, it was really just, I mean, it sounds silly. I've said this on other podcasts too, where like we were just listing things that like, what do you like to draw? Because he's like, I can make up a story. Like sure. We can figure out a story. But, you know, well, I like to draw, and I was just listing things. And we had a list of whatever. And bear, pirate, Viking, queen were on that list. And I think one of us said out of just joking was like, that's a fucking comic book.
There's the title,
like,
right?
And we could call it that. Yeah, like, right. We should call it that. Like, and I think it was like, yeah, but yeah. Like,
yeah.
It kind of could be. And it does, like, kind of have a good,
it has a great role,
rhythm to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's got a great rhythm to it.
So yeah. So it was born of that title.
Yeah.
And then going back and forth with like Sean, I had done a self-published painted book again that I did a Kickstarter for it and then put out myself called Mariner.
Okay.
Which is sort of a thematic continuation of the Coleridge poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Sean, or I gave that to Sean. And so Sean, I think, had an understanding of like, Jonathan wants to be in sort of a lyrical and emotional space. He's probably pretty comfortable with like either grand descriptions or very vague descriptions. Mm-hmm. This was before we were getting to know each other. And Sean was, I guess, comfortable and confident enough that he wrote almost a poem that was like, I think this is the bones of our story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and again, the luxury of living next to each other, living, you know, in the same town was like, we get together and it's like, I think this is something. It's like, oh yeah, this is cool. But like, what if we did this or what if we did that? And then back and forth and back and forth. So, like the collaborative aspect of this was fascinating for me because it really was like, I think this is the first issue of, you know, a three page printed let's call it a poem. I was like, cool, I think that there's something here too, but it's missing like some action.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give anything away, but like it's missing, like there's something in the middle that it needs. So like, I'm going to start drawing this or painting this. And then like, once we get to the middle, I think we need to figure out some new stuff. So while I'm drawing that, Sean's off doing whatever writers do and figuring out like, I think that this is a direction
we
to go.
We dig holes and sit in holes.
Yeah. There's a great clip from Taika Waititi who said it's something where he's like, you know, as a professional writer, sometimes your day is sitting in front of a laptop all day and then 12 hours go by and then you don't write anything and you close the laptop and you feel bad and then you go to bed. And that's what writing was for that day.
I found a golf ball today. Let me just say, I was so excited that I found a golf ball today.
You did it.
Yeah.
You did a thing. Yeah.
I'm writing
that
in my journal tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Dear diary. So, I mean, Sean did whatever he did to figure out like how to break the story, and then we get together and figure out like the next step. And it was important for us in this project to like, Sean loves comic books the way that I love comic books, and we've read a lot of comic books. So we wanted both each issue to be sort of a standalone. If you don't know anything else, then this is a satisfying story. Mm-hmm. But also contribute to a larger narrative, but also to sort of like, if you have read comic books for a little while, at no point or in as few points as we can, are you like predicting like the page turn is the pirate's going to do this, or like the next logical thing is that whatever, he finds Blackbeard's treasure, and then he finds Blackbeard's treasure, and then he challenges the pirate queen, and then he challenges, you know, whatever. So we kind of wanted to avoid that stuff. And, again, being able to work so closely with him was a benefit because we could bounce ideas off of each other so easily.
Yeah. That's super fortunate because this being such a you know, scattered working design, rarely do creators get to share the same space.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. I truly don't know if I've ever even met most of the other people I've worked with.
I had that revelation. I was going through some pages old, you know, from the 90s, and I was going through stuff, and I'm thinking, I have no idea who these people, I couldn't even name the majority of the writers who wrote for me. Like, I can't, I'm like, oh wow. Like, and so I'm going through them, and like, it was just one of these like, oh, okay. Wow. Who knew that person lettered that thing? Like, because I was just so focused on doing the work that I didn't, because I wasn't assembling my Avengers team to go make a comic book. I was being assigned a gig.
Right.
You know, I was just yesterday. I said to someone, I said, if I had my own comic book imprint, I think one of the things that there would be a weekly Zoom call with the team. So they could at least all just be together and talk about the project, so there's a sensibility of we're all in this together doing a thing.
Yeah. That's actually a good idea.
Go ahead, steal it. I don't care.
I'm not starting a company, man. It's hard enough drawing the things.
I know. It's like we said, we come up with an idea to give ourselves more work.
Yeah. I mean, like, to that point though, the benefit of working with Image is that like, we can do whatever we want.
Right.
And the fact that it wasn't like comic book by committee or, I mean, I still speak with and am happy to work with editorial on, you know, Big Two and superhero and whatever, but it's a different animal for sure. Totally. You know, you're going to draw this book. The script is from this guy who lives over there and then it's going to be it's going to be colored by, you know, this artist who's over there. It's a different animal too. We're going to do this ourselves, even if we weren't physically neighbors, you know, like we have complete creative control. So we're going to figure out exactly what we want to do and have, like, you have to have some sort of a personal relationship with someone to make a book the way that we've made a book.
Yeah. I mean, even though I was totally shocked that this wasn't a traditional Marvel property of Bear Pirate Viking Queen,
trademark
right, quickly lock that down. But that's, you know, and this circles back to what we were saying earlier. I mean, it's so, what a legacy and a gift those Image founders that this exists to this day and is facilitating the production and distribution of these comic books, which I don't know. I mean, either there's going to be too many thumbs on the scale if you're going to a different publisher, or it's a Kickstarter project at this point, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a hard, listen.
Yes. It's a difficult road.
It's a very difficult road. The Kickstarter road. And I mean, great to everyone who does it. It's just a very, very rough and emotional journey to do a Kickstarter.
Yeah. And I think, like, again, yeah, all nothing but love to everyone who's making Kickstarter books and self-publishing in any way. But as far as like building, it's a very difficult way to like build a following.
Yeah.
I found, you know, it is
all of it is it tough, is
invaluable
it?
To have.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, but like that image logo in the corner is just like
it's valuable.
It is valuable.
At least you go like, I know what this is. It is
valuable.
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So,
like, even if you're like, at least you're not going to get, you know, I'm so picky. Like, I'm like, oh, the paperweight's too heavy. Like, I get really frustrated if the paperweight's too heavy inside of a book. Like, I'm really like, I like it just to feel right. Like, feel like a comic book. And, you know, and they're not printing my newsprint anymore. So it's going to have to feel like what they feel like now.
This is what I want to do. I want to is make a book on newsprint. Oh, and we spoke to Image about it, and they were, it's hard to find a printer who's able to do that because it's not the cheapest option anymore.
Well, because so this is just in case people don't understand how this works. Comic books until the late-ish 90s, early 2000s were printed in Canada. And they were printed on gigantic things called web presses. And these are what they print newspapers on. And they move at an incredibly fast rate. And your 80,000 copies of Fantastic Four is printed in no time whatsoever. And then it's all ganged up, chopped, and, you know, stapled and trimmed and packed and shipped. Like, it was this huge operation to do that. Now we have digital presses that print these things on glossy sheets of paper that are stacked up nicely at the end of the thing, and those things are, you know, cut, bound, and trimmed, and away they go. Nobody is printing web presses. The web presses are gone. There's like probably like a handful in the country, and it's really heartbreaking, but that's just the way the world works now.
I know. It's There are a couple, though. There are a couple people who are printing, who are still
having well, you'd have to do an offset
printing capabilities. Yes. And that's what nobody knows how to do anymore.
Yeah.
But there are some people who – there are some printing houses who still do offset printing. And that's what I want to do for some comic someday.
Because the difference –
maybe the next comic.
And the reason that, like, comic books, the way they were – okay, so here's – so this is, you know, in the weeds kind of stuff, but – the reason comic books, the printing, the dots so if you looked at a comic book, an old comic book on newsprint, you hold the thing up to it and you can see all the little dots that create the value of the red, the blue, the yellow, whatever it is, and whatever relationship that is creates the overtone of the color that we see. So if it's purple, it's the red and the blue. And that technique is why they printed on newsprint, because it doesn't use a ton of ink. So it doesn't bleed through onto the other side. Newsprint is super absorbent, so it soaks up the ink, and there's no problem. You don't get smearing and blah, blah, blah. You know, registration is your enemy, but otherwise it's okay. Offset printing, especially with the artwork, if you're looking at toned artwork that we do like digitally now, that is not the same light touch of ink comparatively if you were doing offset printing. So I think there would be – I don't think you could use traditional newsprint. You'd have to find some sort of bonded version of a newsprint, which would be
yes.
– you know. So the material selection would feel different regardless. So, I mean, it's an I'm fascinated by this because I'm – you know, my dream is to work with a digital printer to develop a proof of concept modern comic book that could be printed digitally that feels good – and it's economical, that the people who are printing their own comic books could then use this model. Like, hey, here's the model. Mm-hmm. Please make the comic book like this, because I see too many people saying, I print my own comic book, and it's like holding like a stack of cardboard in your hand. And you're like, oh, yeah. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no. Well, I think people just think thicker is better.
It's not.
Like, it's a higher paper quality, right?
Because
because it's heavier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I am also very nostalgic for that newsprint. And and like, as a creative, like, to simplify the kind of work that I want to make so that it can be printed in a traditional way.
Yeah.
So that we can you know, I can have my registration sheets and I can like plan the whole thing out.
Mm-hmm. I'm right there to buy the first issue.
There's nostalgia there, I think, and there's people.
I don't think it's a nostalgia thing. Listen, these are all objects, and if you can make an object that has the quality, like, vinyl is selling well, right? Mm-hmm. The huge number of people buying vinyl weren't alive when vinyl went away. They're not buying it out of nostalgia. They're not going like, boy, I really remember listening to records when I was a kid. They don't have that connection. It's the object. The object, the act of getting up, flipping the thing over, putting the needle back down, listening, hearing the pops and the cracks, all that stuff. It's all part of that experience, which is it's wonderful, you know? You know, I don't know. I think nostalgia has only a limited lifespan, but I think it, the 67 Mustang Fastback is always going to be desired because the object is so beautiful.
Yeah. I think that's a good point.
I don't know. I mean, I want to fight against nostalgia at all costs.
I give nostalgia too much credit because I think that what you're saying is absolutely right.
Well, I don't know. This is me. All right. So I'm such a great diverter of conversations in the sense.
That's fine.
So the book, when is the book coming out? Because that's.
So the first issue is out May 1st.
Sweet. So right around the corner.
Right around the corner. Yeah. So May 1st, June 5th, July. I don't know. It's three issues in the first week of the month. For the next 3 months.
Sweet.
So May 1st is issue number one.
Nice. How do you feel? I mean, like, is this oh, I'm making my baby thing kind of thing?
I'm very excited to have my copies in hand. Mm-hmm. We get advanced copies before the book is in stores, and I think that I should have them soon. And when I have them in hand, then I feel like I will breathe a sigh of relief or break down if there's something wrong.
Just hold your baby.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, well, I mean, I approved every step of the way. So if anything's wrong, then it's something I did wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm super excited. Like, we've had some super positive responses so far from people within the industry and from other artists and writers who we admire. We're going to be doing a signing when the book comes out back in Brooklyn. I haven't talked about this very much. I don't think I've talked about this at all. So exclusive.
Ooh, wow.
Now, we're doing the gallery that I work with in Chelsea in New York is going to be doing a showing of the original pages in June. So I'm going to the gallery and I will officially announce that soon. But, it's the Philippe Le Bon Gallery is in Chelsea and specialized in narrative art. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have a showing of some of the original art. We've got, you read the first issue, the second and third mm-hmm. issue. I think, like I said, like expand upon and take the rug out from the story that we're telling in the first one. So I'm just super excited to share it. Yeah.
I mean, we started off talking about how selfish the act of creating is, right? Yeah. And we give ourselves the guise of like, yeah, but I really want to share this with people. But the thing is, when you've done the thing, that's when you're being honest about the sharing thing. You know what I mean? Like the doing thing isn't so much by that. But once you get that thing done, like you're talking about it, and I'm looking at you, I'm the only one who gets to see you in this conversation for this, but like, I get excited seeing you get excited about it because it's like that's legitimate. That's like you are, you're like, this is going to be the thing that I can't wait that others get to experience.
Yeah. It is true. Yeah, I'm very excited for sure.
I love that.
I mean, that's why we do that. Like, there are easier ways to not make any money. Like, we do this because we love it and we want to share it. So, like, get excited to share the thing that you love. Makes sense to me.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, I think it's great. So, are you doing any conventions this year? Or are you?
I applied to New York Comic Con. Okay. So, just to be in part of Artist Alley. Mm-hmm. I said before, like, we have a little baby now. Yeah. So If any cons want me as a guest, I would
with a baby.
Love to bring my baby. No, I didn't apply to travel anywhere. If anyone, if we have the opportunities to be invited to places, then yeah. Sean and I will take that as it comes. But no, I think just New York.
Cool. Well, all right. So New York Comic Con and May 1st. For yes.
Yeah, May 1st.
Yeah, this is exciting.
We got yeah. Like go out and buy them all so we can have a second printing and then make more cool comic books.
That's the way to please. Do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much. This went by actually really quick.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks, Alex.